This is Mark chapter 1. We're going to begin at verse 21 and read down to verse 39. This is God's perfect and sufficient word speaking to us this morning. And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was a man in their synagogue, a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. And immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and immediately they told him about her. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. And the whole city was gathered together at the door, and he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, and he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." And he said to them, "Let us go on to the next towns, that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out." And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. May the Lord bless the preaching of his word in our midst today. As part of the bedtime routine around our house, we have recently finished reading through the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And because we have small kiddos, we didn't actually read all the way through them. We skipped like large chunks. They talk for a long time and the kids kind of get lost. So we skipped over those to get to the action parts. And if you're a Tolkien purist, don't send me an email telling me how bad of a parent I am to skip the best parts of the book. How could you skip that part? We're going to go back through them, and we'll make our way actually through The Lord of the Rings. But if you aren't familiar with these books, there's one main character. His name is Aragorn. He's the rightful heir to this Middle-earth kingdom, the kingdom of Gondor. But when we first meet him in these books, he's a mysterious stranger. He goes by the name of Strider. He's a feared ranger. Very few people really know who he is. His true identity is hidden. And all along the way, Tolkien is dropping these hints as to who this guy might actually be. But it's in the last book, a book that's fittingly titled Return of the King, where his kingship is revealed in this dramatic moment. You see, Aragorn decides to go to the realm of the dead. He decides to confront a massive army of spirits. These are men who had been banished in the afterlife. They owed a life debt to the true king of Gondor because of treachery that they had committed against this throne while they were alive. So he enters the underworld. He demands their loyalty. There's an upcoming looming battle, and he demands their loyalty, and they are not going to bend their knee. But then he brandishes a sword. And it's a sword that only the true king of Gondor, the rightful heir, can hold. And immediately, this army of spirits, these men who didn't answer to anybody, recognized the man standing before them was no ordinary man. This is the king. This is the one who holds their very lives in his hand. And he has come to claim his rightful place over them. And if they're ever going to escape their cursed state, then they must yield to him as their sovereign. Well, this morning, What we see in our text is that God has a king. God has a king. He has the one, he is the one who has been hinted at from the very beginning of Scripture. From the dawn of Scripture, God's king has been hinted at. And now he has finally stepped into history to begin to claim his rightful place. But rather than just telling us this, Mark wants us to see this. He begins to paint, he recounts a vivid, a compelling portrayal. This is one day in the life of Christ, and it's coming from Peter's own hometown of Capernaum. In the course of 24 hours, we are confronted with this one, the one who is worthy of our love and our very lives. Mark wants us. He wants us to know what he knows. That's why he's telling us these stories. He wants us to know what he knows. The true king has come. He has come to claim his rightful place. And the only appropriate response to this king is happy submission to his good reign in our lives. That's the main point of this passage. If you want to know what the main point of this passage is, the true king has come to claim his rightful place. And the only appropriate response is happy submission to his good reign over our lives. As Mark often does, there are several rapid fire. They're kind of mini stories, if you will. And he bundles them together. He puts them together to drive home this one main point. And so each different vignette conveys another aspect of this true king's reign, what it looks like. And so our structure this morning is going to form around those three different scenes, all contributing to this one main point. Those three points we see in verses 21 to 28. This is our structure. This king, he reigns with absolute authority. That's in verses 21 to 28. This king, he reigns with absolute authority. But then we see in verses 29 to 34, the second scene, this king reigns with a compassionate authority. He reigns with a compassionate authority. And then finally, we're going to look at verses 35 to 39, the last scene that we see. This king reigns with delegated authority. He reigns with delegated authority. So let's dive into that first part. The king reigns with absolute authority. Right away that we see in verse 1 that Jesus' presence causes quite a stir in the synagogue. They were used to traveling preachers coming through town. They would be able to come to the synagogue when everyone gathers and have something to share with the people. That was not uncommon. That was a common occurrence. But what the people had not experienced was anyone like this teacher. They'd heard a lot of other people before, but they'd never heard anyone like this. And we see that in verse 2. You see that? They are astonished. That's their response at his teaching. As he begins to teach the people, they're astonished. And here's why they're astonished. That's the reason why they're astonished. For he taught as one who had authority. That's what creates their astonishment. When Jesus starts preaching, the people, they're in shock. Jesus hasn't come riding in with military power like the Romans had done. He hasn't come in with social status and possibly position like many of their leaders possessed. Those were the kinds of authorities that they were used to. Those things were kind of, that authority structure was just woven into their life, and they were used to that. But Jesus, when he shows up, he is altogether different. He's in a whole other category. He's different than what they knew. He possesses an authority that stretches beyond human authority. His authority wasn't just quantitatively different. It wasn't more of the same. That's what it's saying here. His authority was qualitatively different. It's in a different class altogether. They had nothing to compare it to. That's why Mark includes this note here that says, Jesus' teaching is not like the scribes. It is a supernatural authority. And it stuns those who had gathered around. When they see it, it stuns them. And we see this supernatural authority begin to play itself out over these next few verses. That's what we see again in verses 23 and 24. Look down there. It says, immediately there's a man in their synagogue and he has an unclean spirit. And what does he do? He cries out. He says, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." As Jesus begins to exercise this supernatural authority through teaching, you almost see that this he provokes a confrontation immediately. We get the impression that this demon, he can't help himself. He feels cornered. He has to cry out. And so he does. He lashes out. And to this point, this unclean spirit that's been possessing this man has held him in his power. He's held him in his control. The demon leads and the man acts. That's how this works. It's free reign he gets to have over this man's life. But as soon as Christ physically steps into the synagogue, as soon as that happens, the whole balance of power is obliterated. It's gone. Seemingly unchallengeable to everyone else, this unclean spirit, immediately before Christ, he's set to groveling. Because one has arrived who can eternally destroy him, and he is fully aware of that. And notice here that he uses this plural pronoun. He says, "Have you come to destroy us?" So this isn't a matter of numbers. He knows that if they were all to gang up together and come against this Christ, it still wouldn't matter. It wouldn't make a difference. "Have you come to destroy us?" It's striking if we read through the Gospels. If you just go through the Gospels, and you take into account, just jot down over and over again, the reactions of unclean spirits or demons when they encounter Christ. It's striking how similar those reactions are. They happen over and over and over again because, get this, they absolutely know who he is. They get it. They know the total authority that he arrives with. It goes before him. They get that before them, standing in front of them is this king that the psalmist had talked about in Psalm 2. We've heard echoes of that particular psalm already in this opening chapter talking about Christ. But listen to this description here. The psalmist captures a prophetic word. God is talking about his son in this psalm. Listen to the words of Psalm 2 talking about the son. It says, "I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. And you shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling.'" This demon recognizes who this man is. He says, I know who you are. The other people around here may not see it, but I know. You are the Holy One of God. And just in case we're tempted to doubt that Jesus is only a man of words and not a man of action, we see that his absolute authority is on display in verses 25 to 28. You see that there? Jesus rebukes him. He says, "You be silent," and you come out of him. And the unclean spirit convulses the man. He cries out and he comes out. And all the people, they're amazed. They question among themselves. Look at this. What is this? That's their question. What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits. And they obey him. And at once his fame spread throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. Make no mistake, the demon, he causes a scene here, right? But there is no back and forth. There is no power struggle. There is no fight here. Whatever Jesus says immediately goes. And having seen this kind of authority, the people are forced. They don't have a choice. They're forced to ask among themselves, to wonder among themselves, who is this? Who is this person that is standing before us? That's the question that when they encountered Christ was forced upon them. When they see his absolute authority, it's the first thing that came to mind. Who is this? Who can do this? And it's the same question that all of us must reckon with. Before us, what we're reading here before us in these pages is no ordinary human. We're to look at this account and we're to see for ourselves and be led to the same question. Who is this? Who is this that's before us in these verses? Who is this that holds absolute authority? Is this not the king of Psalm 2? Is this not the beloved son who can say whatever he wishes and it will immediately go? Who is this? Listen, Jesus, he didn't walk into that synagogue. He didn't walk into that synagogue primarily to inform people, although it included information. He walked into that synagogue to stake his rightful claim in Capernaum. That's what he walked in to do. And oh, when we start to hear things like that in a comfortable America in 2020, it starts to make us so very uncomfortable, doesn't it? Because it means he has the same right to do so here. Listen, in a world of pluralism, a world of hot takes, we're a lot more comfortable with a Jesus who doesn't come with just quite this much authority. He's allowed in so long as he brings positive energy, so long as he plays by the rules, so long as he gets along with everybody else. But anybody coming in and demanding absolute authority, they're not welcome around these parts. And even in the church, among those who claim the name of Christ, how often is his authority trampled on? How often is it maligned and undermined? How often is he allowed in as long as my life gets easier and he stays in his lane? If he wants to help me with 5 green lights in a row on my way to work, I'm good with that. But when he wants to start talking to me about my relationships and what I do with my free time, he doesn't get final say there. He doesn't get final say there. Listen, even in the church, even among those who belong to Christ, we must be freshly confronted by the shock of Capernaum. Jesus will always arrive with absolute authority. His reign is not one that we get to pick and choose from. And Christ's authority, make no mistake, Christ's authority is going to make us uncomfortable somewhere. His authority will make us, it will challenge us somewhere. Because if his authority is never makes you uncomfortable, if it never bothers you, if it never speaks to your sin and calls for you to change, if it never confronts an area of your life that you need to repent of, you may want to ask, have you met this King, the Jesus of Scripture? The true King has come to claim his rightful place. And the only appropriate response is happy submission to his good reign over our lives. It's the only appropriate response. And I want to include a side note here, because it's possible, maybe even likely in a crowd this size, that the idea of absolute authority makes you bristle. That's because of something that may have happened to you in your past, somewhere along the way, because somebody, somewhere, that you were powerless against, sinned grievously against you. And maybe it even came from somebody who should have been using their authority, their role in your life to protect you, and they did not do that. Now you have this concrete determination that I will never be powerless again. No one, not even Jesus himself, is going to have that kind of control over me. I will never accept that level of authority willingly. I categorically refuse. And if that's you this morning, maybe your mind is already starting to race right now as you're encountering his absolute authority. Because this has been a long, drawn-out battle between you and Jesus. I want you to hear first that I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the suffering. I'm sorry for the agony that you've had to walk through because of that. It isn't right. But I also want to ask you to please hang in here. Please hang in here. Don't eject. Because there are wonderful things, there are magnificent things about the reign and the power of this king. He is altogether different than what you have experienced before. Completely different. There's wonderful things to see here. Stay with the text. This king doesn't just reign with an absolute power. He does. But church, he reigns. He reigns with a compassionate authority. His power is not wielded to take. He exercises it to give. That's what he's like. Look at the scene in this next section, the second section. It shifts to the home of Peter's in-laws. And again, Mark is highlighting the authority of Christ, but now he begins to introduce a new element. He accents the compassion of Jesus. For the first time in this gospel, we see the power of Christ on display to heal. That's in verses 30 and 31. It says, "Now Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and immediately they told him about her. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the fever left her. And she began to serve them." Consider this snapshot that we see right here. The one who was just teaching, the one who before the crowds had awe-inspiring authority, the one who could command demons and they immediately respond. This is the same one who now steps to the bedside of this elderly lady. And the hand that grasps literally the very scepter of heaven stretches out to take her by the hand and to lift her up with healing power. And it isn't a halfway healing, it's an all-the-way healing. We see that there. She gets up immediately, fever's gone, she's able to serve them. And then Mark pans out even wider to see the compassion of this king. In response to the testimony that's been spreading all around town, the people come pouring in. It says the whole town came. We see that in verses 32 to 34. The whole town comes. At sundown, they wait till the Sabbath ends, and then they bring to him all who are sick or oppressed by demons. And the whole city gathers at the door. And look what he does. He healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, and he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. Consider this scene. Consider what's unfolding here. In any history book that you've ever read, in any documentary that you've ever watched, have you ever seen a monarch in this setting? I had the privilege years ago to visit Buckingham Palace in London. And in case you're wondering, they did not invite me in. I got to stand on the street with everyone else, especially the Americans. You get to stand over there behind the gates and you get to peer through, not too long, but you get to look and wonder what it would like to be on the other side. A royal summons doesn't just happen. And yet here we find this king. He's sitting patiently in the home, simple home probably, a blue-collar fisherman. And he's sitting there until late in the night. He's completely in his element. He's completely in his element. Almost as if welcoming them in is why he came. And one after the other, he takes the time to listen. He takes the time to hear their urgent pleas, their deepest needs, and he's able to meet every single one of them. See that there? Every single one. There's no limit to what he can't meet. There's no limit to his compassion in meeting those needs. And we want to take a minute just to consider the juxtaposition of these two scenes that we've just seen. Consider this. It's extraordinary to take in. How is it possible? How is it possible? Unquestioned, unbridled power, followed by perfect humility and the deepest empathy we've ever seen. How is that possible that those two reside in the same person? In the same king? We're used to one or the other. Strong here, weak here. Here they are, both and, residing in the person, in the reign of Christ. Listen, humanity has never known a ruler who was actually worthy of holding absolute authority before. They've never known it. Unchecked power, go back and look, unchecked power, it never goes well. Even in our time, we sadly see reminders daily from the headlines. You can take them out of the headlines. That's still the case. But what the Bible is setting before us, what Scripture, what Mark is telling us, is that this is an altogether different king. This is a sovereign who exercises unrelenting power over the principalities of this world. And yet, this is a friend who eagerly sits with the lowly subjects. This is what God's anointed looks like. He is a king who reigns with compassionate authority. Finally, Mark caps off this day in Capernaum with one final aspect of Jesus' authority. And if possible, it's as stunning or maybe even more so than the previous scene. This is the final scene. The king reigns with delegated authority. He reigns with delegated authority. You probably see in most translations a heading above verse 35, and it says something along the lines of, Jesus preaches in Galilee. And in many ways, those headlines, they serve us very well. But at the same time, we don't want to allow a non-inspired insertion to break the flow of the original text. So if you're reading through the original, you just keep going from verse 34 to 35, you see a contrast. And that's what we're supposed to see, this shocking contrast that starts to show up. We want to notice that because there is deep theology crammed into that contrast. Listen, the difference between a Sabbath evening and an early morning teaches us much about God the Son. It teaches us much about God the Son. The difference between Sabbath evening and early morning is going to tell us a lot about God the Son. He rises before the rest of his sleeping disciples, probably sleeping into us sounded good in his human state. He probably has not slept. Many of you have had that experience this week, the idea of getting up early in the morning. And just in case you're wondering, it's before the sun comes up, so Mark makes sure to know it's very early in the morning. And he slips away to pray. We see that in verses 35 to 37. It says, rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place. And there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him. This is what they said. They said to him, everyone is looking for you. Jesus goes to the very last place that his disciples expect him to go. And we get the very strong impression that the disciples, men who just a few verses earlier, maybe a day earlier, had left everything to follow him, sounds like us, doesn't it? Within a day, they're already starting to correct him. They're already starting to come out there and say, Jesus, I'm not sure if you know how this works, but everybody in town, they love you. If they love you, listen, if you're wanting to establish a kingdom, back there is a pretty good start. That's a great place to go. You could set up shop there today. You don't have to consult with anybody. You don't have to wait. You can do literally whatever you want to do there. The possibilities are endless. So why in the world are you of all people out here by yourself early in the morning praying? It's the kind of question that we're going to keep bumping into repeatedly in Mark. These kinds of questions are going to be the questions because We're going to be like the disciples. We're going to be right alongside them all along the way. We're going to be having the same question, why? We're meant to ask that. We're meant to be there and say, why are you out here? Why aren't you back there? On these last two closing verses, verse 38 and 39, we start to get the first hints of an answer. Jesus says to them, let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also. For that is why I came out. And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. Jesus, he finishes praying, or more likely he's interrupted in his praying. And he says, okay, it's time to move on. It's time to keep going. Let's go to the next towns. And from our human perspective, this way of establishing God's kingdom, it's entirely off. It's entirely off. It's the exact opposite of how we would draw it up. Everyone knows you establish a base, and then you build off of that. That's how you build a kingdom. And yet from heaven's perspective, this king is doing exactly what he's been authorized to do. You see, he went to the next town because he didn't come to exercise political authority, to overthrow kings. He went to the next town because he came to wield divine authority. He came to rescue sinners. Listen, this is how God established his kingdom. By proclaiming good news to his enemies. That's how he established his kingdom. You see, Jesus, he had a delegated authority. It was at God's bidding that he went from one town to the next. But what did he go to do to tell this band of rebels, each band of rebels, what was he telling them? He was declaring to them, there is reconciliation available with God. That's why I came, is to tell you that. To all of you who owe a life debt that you can never repay, there is full pardon. To all of you who have been treacherous and rebellious against God, there is forgiveness for you. To all of those of you who are toiling away under the slavery of your sin, there's liberation to be found. To all of those who are at open war with God, there is peace to be had with him. You see, Jesus is claiming his rightful rule over us so that he can save us. That's why he came. As John Piper puts it, yes, the Lord reigns. Yes, the kingdom has come. But no, that is not good news. Until we hear that the king has come to die for his rebellious subjects. Justice will be done. Righteousness will be vindicated. The glory of the king will be upheld, and wonder of wonders, rebels will be pardoned, even adopted into the king's family. That's what Mark wants us to see this morning, out here in this desolate place. That is why Jesus was out praying. That is why he was preaching from town to town. Listen, the true king has come to claim his rightful place over our lives. But he has sealed that claim with his very own blood. So before we close this morning, I want to talk to two different groups of people who are present here today. First, perhaps you're here and you've never confessed Jesus as the Christ. You've never bowed your knee in faith to him. Maybe you have even outwardly conformed to Christianity along the way. You've kind of adopted the rules. But deep down, you're still keeping Jesus at an arm's distance. You're still resisting his reign in your life because you just don't quite trust him yet. If that's you, let me urge you to do that this morning. Listen, He holds, you may not realize this, he holds claim over your life even as you sit there, even right now. Your very heart beats at his pleasure. So don't wait. Heed the warning that we heard in Psalm 2. Come. He's worth coming to. He's worth coming to. See him as he really is. Not as we thought of him. Not as what we've assumed that his reign would be like. See him as he really is here. And happily submit to this king. Listen, his claim, it's absolute yes. But it's a compassionate claim. We come trembling and yet we come boldly. He welcomes all who will bring their deepest needs to him. All those who are willing to bring their sin, crushing weight of their burdens, he welcomes. Listen, the people in this passage, they were rewarded. They were rewarded because they heard about him and they came to find him without delay. They brought their needs to the right place. Listen, if they were welcomed in, why won't you be? There's no reason to hesitate. You can come right now just as you are. There are no preconditions to confess him as Lord. There are no hoops that you have to jump through to join his kingdom. In fact, if you spend time on the outside trying to clean yourself up first, it's possible, it's quite possible that you will miss it altogether. Don't get it backwards. Being a Christian isn't about who you are or where you're from or what you've done or how you're improving. It's all about who you're coming to. So don't let anybody keep you from coming. The only requirements are that you come and that you bring your whole mess with you. There isn't anything that this wise ruler can't handle. Someone greater than Solomon is here. And look down again. If you're still wrestling, look down again. Everyone in town came. Let them be your example. Let them be your encouragement. Let them be your push out the door. Just say, look, if they can come, I'm going to look down there. I'm going to determine. If they can come, I'm going to fix it in my mind. I can come too. I can be just like them. I've heard this story. I can come. If I've heard the story, I can come. They heard, they came. That can be you this morning. Listen, is there anybody else out there that you've found who is worthy of giving yourself to? Listen, this king, his reign was inaugurated by a crown of thorns, and his coronation was a purple robe of mockery. Here we find a king who has used his authority to love you to the uttermost. His reign never stops in this book. It never stops. Listen, when we get to the points all along the way where it seems like he's not in control, that's not the case. Jesus was reigning supreme as he stood in your place before Pontius Pilate and responded, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above." He was reigning supreme as he faces accusations, the same accusations that you've heard deep down in your own soul. He reigns supreme as he's bearing stripes on his back in order to bring us healing. He's reigning supreme as he carries our blood-soaked cross of shame outside the city so that we no longer have to hide. He's reigning supreme as his hands are stretched wide and his feet are nailed to this tree so that our record of debt, our record of transgressions against him are publicly canceled. He's reigning supreme as he's cast out in utter horror from the presence of his Father so that we could be brought in. All of that, all of those things, everything that happened to Jesus Christ, it happened under his control. And it happened that way because that's what this king came to do. He came with absolute authority, and he used that authority to lay down his life in our place. It's the highest expression of power there has ever been. So let me ask again, what is keeping you this morning from happily submitting to that king? It's the illusion of control, some fear that he isn't going to be as great as he claims to be. fear of what others might think, a certain lifestyle. Will any of those things matter when this king comes back? The one who holds absolute authority? Whatever it is, will it matter when he returns? If you've never called on Christ, you can do so today. You can see this king and you can come to him. You can come right now. There is room for you. Second, for those who are here and you do belong to Christ, you've trusted him to be your Lord and your Savior. Let me ask this. What primarily comes to mind? Primarily comes to mind when you look in the mirror in the morning. When you consider your own identity, what is it that comes to the surface? Listen, we're all asked to wear a lot of different hats in this life. We're students, and we're employees, and we're moms, and we're soccer players, and we're husbands, and we're tutors, and we're safe drivers with discounts. Have all these different roles. But all of those callings in life, as important as they are, and they're vital, all of those roles fall under the domain. They serve the ultimate purpose of one overarching role that has been bestowed upon us as God's people. Here's that overarching role, the one that defines everything else for us. We are happy servants of the true King. We're happy servants of the true King. And referring to himself, often Paul would call himself, he would reference himself as a doulos, or a slave of Jesus Christ. He wasn't claiming here that he was his own person who happens to be serving Christ. He's saying that he personally, Paul, the way he viewed himself, I personally belong to Jesus. Christ owns me. I am an eternally loved, blood-bought subject of this heavenly King. And it was in light of that understanding, that self-understanding, it was in light of that that he gave, and he worked, and he ate, and he served. All of it was in light of that. If happy servant of Christ isn't one of the primary ways that you think about yourself, that you consider yourself, if that is not the lens that you see your decisions through, that you see your time and your finances and even what you are willing to sacrifice for, if that's not the lens that you see those things through, happy servant of the true King, then something's off. Something is out of place. Our priorities are misplaced. You see, it's out of loving devotion to Him that everything else in our lives is meant to flow. It's out of loving devotion to Him that everything else in our lives is meant to flow. Sometimes living out the Christian life, it can feel overwhelming. It can feel complicated for us. But it's through this time that we spend on bended knee. It's through this time that we bow before our gracious King. In those moments, we're able to see a little clearer. We're able to understand that His yoke is easy. And His burden is light. So if you lost that somewhere along the way, that reminder, and for you, you'd say, following Jesus for me, it's increasingly felt more like a drudgery than a joy. It's what it's felt like for me. I want the final word. Listen to this final word from Psalm 2. This is the final word that the psalmist writes about this King. The final promise that comes to us for those who are with this King. Let it serve as a direct reminder to our souls this morning. Blessed. Blessed are all who take refuge in Him. We take refuge in this King. And we find blessing. The true King has come to claim his rightful place. And the only appropriate response is happy submission to his good reign over our lives. close in prayer.